Noted. But do you not think it is a poor substitute for conscience? Speaking as a minister, I mean.
Well, I do,
Roger said, somewhat surprised.
It would be best for men to deal decently with one another in accordance with,
well, with God's principles, if you'll pardon my putting it that way.
But what are you to do first, if you have men to whom God is of no account? And second, if you have men, and you do always, who own no power greater than their own?
Fraser nodded, interested.
Aye, well, it's true that the best conscience will not avail a man who will not mind it.
But what do you do when conscience speaks differently to men of goodwill?
As in political disputes, you mean? Supporters of the Stuarts versus those of the House of Hanover?
It was a reckless thing to say, but it might help him to figure out when he was, and he meant to say nothing that might make it look as though he had a personal stake on either side. Fraser's face underwent a surprising flow of expression, from being taken aback to mild distaste, this then ending in a look of half-amused ruefulness.
Like that, he agreed.
I fought for the House of Stuart in my youth, and while I'd not say that conscience didn't come into it, it didn't come very far onto the field, Weimer.
His mouth quirked at the corner, and Roger felt again the tiny plop of a stone tossed into his depths, the ripples of recognition spreading through him.
Jamie did that. Brianna didn't. Jem did. He couldn't stop to think about it, though. The conversation was teetering delicately on the precipice of an invitation to political disclosure, and that he couldn't do.
"Was it Sheriff Muir?"
he asked, making no effort to disguise his interest.
"It was?"
Fraser said, openly surprised. He eyed Roger dubiously.
"You canna have gone yourself, surely. Did your feyther maybe tell you?"
"No," said Roger, with the momentary twinge that thought of his father always brought. In fact, Fraser was only a few years older than himself, but he knew the other man doubtless took him for a decade younger than he was.
"I heard a song about it. 'Twas two shepherds met on a hillside, talking about the great fight, and arguing who'd won it."
That made Fraser laugh.
"Well, they might. We were arguing that before we finished picking up the wounded."
He took a sip of whiskey and washed it meditatively around his mouth, clearly reminiscing.
"So, then, how does the song go?"
Roger breathed deep, ready to sing, and then remembered. Fraser had seen his rope scar and been tactful enough not to remark on it, but no need to make the damage obvious. Instead, he chanted the first few lines, tapping his fingers on the desk, echoing the rhythm of the big boron that was the song's only accompaniment.
"Oh, come ye here to fight to shun or herd the sheep wi' me, man? Or were ye at the Sheramoor, or did the battle see, man? I saw the battle sair and chuch, and reeking red ran money a shuch, my heart for fear and skade sooch for sooch, to hear the thuds and see the cluds o' clans free woods and tartan duds, who are glommed at kingdoms free, man."
It went better than he'd thought. The song really was more chanted than sung, and he'd managed the whole of it with no more than the odd choke or cough. Fraser was rapt, glass forgotten in his hand.
"Oh, that's braw, man," Fraser exclaimed. "So young poet's got the devil of an accent. Where's he come from, d'ye ken?" Ayrshire, I think."
Fraser shook his head in admiration and sat back.
"Could you maybe write it down for me?"
he asked almost shyly.
"I wouldn't have put you to the trouble of singing it again. I'd dearly love to learn the whole of it."
Sure, Roger said, taken aback. Well, what harm could it do to let Robert Burns's poem loose in the world some years in advance of Burns himself?
"Can anyone who can play a boron? It's best with a drum rattling in the background."
He tapped his fingers in illustration.
"Oh, aye."
Fraser was rustling about in the drawer of his desk. He came out with several sheets of foolscap, most with writing on them. Frowning, he flipped through the papers, picked one, and pulled it from the sheaf, placing it face down in front of Roger, offering him the blank backside. There were goose quills, rather tattered from use, but well-trimmed, in a jar on the desk, and a brass inkstand, which Fraser offered him with a generous sweep of one broad hand.
"My son's friend plays well. He's gone for a soldier, though, more's the pity."
A shadow crossed Fraser's face.
"Ach."
Roger clicked his tongue in sympathy. He was trying to make out the writing that showed faintly through the sheet.
"Joined a Highland regiment, did he?"
"No," Fraser said, sounding a little startled.
"Christ, were there Highland regiments yet? He's gone to France as a mercenary soldier. Better pay, fewer floggings than the army, he tells his da."
Roger's heart lifted. Yes, it was a letter or maybe a journal entry. Whatever it was, there was a date on it. 17... Was that a 3? Had to be. Couldn't be an 8. 173? It might be a 9 or a 0. Couldn't tell for sure through the paper. No, it had to be a 9. So, 1739. He breathed a sigh of relief. Something October 1739.
"Probably safer,"
he said, only half attending to the conversation as he'd begun to scratch out the lines. It was some time since he'd written with a quill, and he was awkward.
"Safer?" "Aye," he said, "from the point of view of disease, mostly. Most men that die in the army die of some sickness, Ken. Comes from the crowding, having to live in barracks, eat army rations. I'd think mercenaries might have a bit more freedom."
Fraser muttered something about freedom to starve, but it was half under his breath. He was tapping his own fingers on the desk, trying to catch the rhythm as Roger wrote. He was surprisingly rather good. By the time the song was finished, he was singing it softly in a pleasant low tenor and had the drumming down pretty well. Roger's mind was divided between the task in front of him and the feel of the letter under his hand. The feel of the paper and the look of the ink reminded him vividly of the wooden box filled with Jamie's and Claire's letters. He had to stop himself from glancing at the shelf where it would be kept when this room was his. They'd been rationing the letters, reading them slowly, but when Jem was taken, all bets were off. They'd rushed through the whole of the box looking for any mention of Jem, any indication that he might have escaped from Cameron and found his way to the safety of his grandparents. Not a word about Jem. Not one. They'd been so distraught that they'd scarcely noticed anything else the letters said. But occasional phrases and images floated up in his mind quite randomly, some of them distinctly disturbing. Brianna's uncle Ian had died, but scarcely noticeable at the time. They weren't anything he wanted to think about now, either.
"Will your son be studying the law, then, in Paris?" Roger asked abruptly.
He picked up the fresh dram Brian had poured for him and took a sip.
"Aye, well, he'd maybe make a decent lawyer," Fraser admitted. "He could argue you into the ground, I'll say that for him. But I think he hasn't got the patience for law or politics."
He smiled suddenly.
"Jamie sees at once what he thinks should be done, and cannot understand why anyone else would think otherwise. And he'd rather pound someone than persuade them, if it comes to that."
Roger laughed ruefully.
"I understand the urge," he said. "Oh, indeed,"
Fraser nodded, leaning back a little in his chair.
"And I'll no say as that's not a necessary thing to do on occasion, especially in the Highlands."
He grimaced, but not without humour.
"So then, why do you think this Cameron has stolen your land?" Fraser asked bluntly.
Roger wasn't surprised. As well as they'd been getting on together, he'd known Fraser had to be wondering just how much Roger was telling and how truthful he was. Well, he'd been ready for that question, and the answer was at least a version of the truth.
"We lived for a time in America," he said,
and felt a pang with the saying of it. For an instant, their snug cabin on the ridge was around him.
Brianna asleep with her hair loose on the pillow beside him, and the children's breath a sweet fog above them.
America?
Fraser exclaimed in astonishment.
Where, then? The colony of North Carolina, a good place,
Roger hastened to add,
but not without its dangers. Name me one, that is,
Fraser said, but waved that aside.
And these dangers made you come back.
Roger shook his head, a tightness in his throat at the memory.
No, it was our wee lass,
Mandy. Amanda, she's called. She was born with a thing wrong with her heart, and there was no physician there who could treat it. So we came back, and while we were in Scotland, my wife inherited some land, and so we stayed, but...
He hesitated, thinking how to put the rest. But knowing what he did of Fraser's antecedents and his history with the Mackenzies of Leoch, the man probably wouldn't be overly disturbed at his story.
My wife's father, he said carefully, is a good man, a very good man, but the sort who draws attention, a leader of men, and one that other men... Well, he told me once that his own father had said to him that since he was a large man, other men would try him. And they do.
He watched Brian Fraser's face carefully at this, but beyond the twitch of an eyebrow, there was no apparent response.
I'll not go into all the history of it, since it hasn't happened yet. But the long and the short of it is that my father-in-law was left in possession of a large sum in gold. He does not regard it as his own property, but as something held in trust. Still, there it is. And while it's been kept secret so far as possible...
Fraser made a sympathetic sound, acknowledging the difficulties of secrecy in such conditions.
So this Cameron learned of the treasure, did he, and thought to extort it from your father-in-law by taking the bairn captive?
Fraser's dark brow lowered at the thought.
That may be in his mind, but beyond that, my son kens where the gold is hidden. He was with his grandfather when it was put away safe. Only the two of them ken the whereabouts. But Cameron learned that my son knew the place. Ah.
Brian sat for a moment, staring into his whiskey, thinking. Finally, he cleared his throat and looked up, meeting Roger's eyes.
I maybe shouldn't say such a thing, but it may be in your own mind already. If he's taken the boy only because the lad kens where yon treasure is. Well, was I a wicked man with no scruples, I think I might force the information out of the lad so soon as I had him alone.
Roger felt the cold slide of the suggestion down into the pit of his belly. It was something that had been at the back of his own mind, though he hadn't admitted it to himself.
Make him tell. And then kill him, you mean?
Fraser grimaced unhappily.
I did not want to think it, he said. But without the lad, what is there to mark him out? A man alone? He could travel as he liked without much notice. Yes,
Roger said, and stopped to breathe.
Yes. Well, he didn't. I know the man a little. I don't think he'd do that, murder.
His throat closed suddenly and he coughed violently.
Murder a child,
he finished hoarsely.
He wouldn't.
They gave him a room at the end of the hallway on the second floor. When his family would live here, this would be the children's playroom. He undressed to his shirt, put out the candle, and got into bed, resolutely ignoring the shadows in the corners that held the ghosts of giant cardboard building blocks, of dollhouses, six guns, and chalkboards. The fringed skirt of Mandy's Annie Oakley costume fluttered at the corner of his eye. He ached from follicles to toenails, inside and out, but the panic engendered by his arrival had passed. How he felt didn't matter, though. The question was, what now? They hadn't gone where they thought, he and Buck, but he had to assume that they had ended up in the right place, the place where Jem was. How else could they have come here?
Perhaps Rob Cameron knew more now about how the travelling worked, could control it, and had deliberately brought Jem to this time in order to frustrate pursuit. He was too exhausted to keep hold of his thoughts, let alone string them into coherence. He pushed everything out of his mind so far as he could, and lay still, staring into the dark, seeing the shine of a rocking horse's eyes. Then he got out of bed, knelt on the cold boards, and prayed. Chapter 32. For many men who stumble at the threshold are well foretold that danger lurks within. Lallybroch, October the 31st, 1980. Brianna couldn't open her own front door. She kept trying, rattling the big iron key all over the escutcheon plate, until the WPC took it from her shaking hand and got it into the keyhole. She hadn't started to shake until the police car turned up the lane to Lallybroch. "Rather an old lock," the police constable observed, giving it a dubious look. "Original to the house, is it?" She lifted her head, peering up at the white harled front of a house, pursing her lips at the sight of the lintel with its carved date. "I don't know. We don't usually lock the door. We've never had burglars." Brianna's lips felt numb, but she thought she'd managed a weak smile. Luckily, Mandy was unable to contradict this bald-faced lie, as she'd seen a toad in the grass by the path, and was following it, poking at it with the toe of her shoe to make it hop. Jemmy, glued protectively to Brianna's side, made a low noise in his throat that reminded her startlingly of her father, and she looked down at him, narrowing her eyes. He made the noise again and looked away. There was a rattle and click as the lock opened, and the constable straightened up with a pleased sound. "Hey, that's done it. Now you're quite sure as you'll be all right, will you, Mrs. Mackenzie?" the woman said, giving her a dubious look. "Out here by yourself and your man away." "He'll be home soon," Brianna assured her, though her stomach went hollow at the words. The woman eyed her consideringly, then gave a reluctant nod and pushed open the door. "Well, then, you know best, I expect. I'll just check to see that your phone's in order, and all the doors and windows locked, shall I, while you have a look round to be sure everything's as it should be?" The lump of ice that had formed in her middle during the long hours of questioning shot straight up into her chest. I'm sure everything's fine." But the constable had already gone inside and was waiting impatiently for her. "Jem, bring Mandy inside and take her up to the playroom, will you?" She couldn't bear to leave the kids outside by themselves, exposed. She could scarcely bear to have them out of her sight. But the very last thing she needed was to have Mandy tagging helpfully along, chatting to Constable Loughlin about Mr. Rob in the priest's hole. Leaving the door open, she hurried after the WPC. "The phone's in there," she said, catching up with Constable Loughlin in the hall and gesturing toward Roger's study. "There's an extension in the kitchen. I'll go and check that and see to the back door." Not waiting for an answer, she strode down the hall and nearly threw herself through the swinging door that led to the kitchen. She didn't pause to check anything, but jerked open the junk drawer and snatched up a big rubber-covered flashlight. Meant to assist farmers lambing at night or searching for lost stock, the thing was a foot long and weighed nearly 2 pounds. The 22 caliber rifle was in the mudroom, and for an instant, as she walked through the house, she debated killing him in a dispassionate way that would probably scare her if she had time to think about it. She had Jem back, after all. But no, Constable Loughlin would certainly recognise the sound of a shot, in spite of the muffling green baize on the kitchen door. And there was apparently more she needed to learn from Rob Cameron. She'd knock him unconscious and tape his mouth. She stepped into the mudroom and quietly closed the kitchen door behind her. There was a deadbolt, but she couldn't lock it from this side without the key, and her keys were on the table in the foyer where Constable Loughlin had left them. Instead,
She dragged the heavy bench over and jammed it catty-corner between the door and the wall, concentrating on the logistics. Where was the best place to hit someone on the head so as to render them unconscious without fracturing their skull? She had a vague memory of her mother mentioning that once. The occiput? She'd expected an outcry from Cameron at the sound of her entry, but he didn't peep. She could hear footsteps above, the confident stride of an adult going down the hall. Constable Loughlin on her tour of inspection, no doubt checking the first floor windows, ladder-bearing burglars in mind. She closed her eyes for an instant, envisioning the constable sticking her head into the playroom just as Mandy was regaling her brother with the details of her own adventures the night before. Nothing to be done about that. She took a deep breath, lifted the grate over the priest's hole, and shone the light down into the shadows. The empty shadows. For a few moments she went on looking, swinging the torch beam from one side of the priest's hole to the other, then back again, her mind simply refusing to believe her eyes. The light caught the dull gleam of duct tape, two or three discarded wads flung into a corner. There was a cold feeling at the back of her neck, and she jerked round, flashlight raised, but it was no more than apprehension. No one was there. The outer door was locked, the mudroom windows secure. The door was locked. She made a small, frightened sound and clapped her hand hard over her mouth. Like the door between mudroom and kitchen, the mudroom's outer door locked with a deadbolt from the inside. If someone had gone out that way and left the door locked behind him, he had a key to the house. And her rifle was gone. They're too little, she kept thinking. They shouldn't know about things like this. They shouldn't know it's possible. Her hands were shaking. It took three tries to open the sticky drawer in Mandy's dresser. And after the third failure, she pounded it in a fury with the side of her fist, whispering through gritted teeth, "You goddamn fucking bloody buggering thing! Don't you dare get in my way!" She crashed her fist on top of the dresser, raised her foot, and smashed the sole of her sneaker into the thing so hard that it rocked back and thumped into the wall with a bang. She grabbed the drawer pulls and yanked. The terrorized drawer shot out, and she snatched the whole thing free and flung it into the opposite wall, where it struck and exploded in a rainbow spray of underpants and tiny striped T-shirts. She walked over and looked down at the battered drawer lying upside down on the floor. "So there," she said calmly, "teach you to get in my way when I have things to think about."
"Like what, ma'am?" said a cautious voice from the doorway.
She looked up to see Jemmy hovering there, eyes flicking from her to the mistreated drawer and back. "Oh." She thought of trying to explain the drawer, but instead cleared her throat and sat down on the bed, holding out a hand to him.
"Come here, Avalach."
His ginger brows flicked up at the Gallic endearment, but he came willingly, cuddling into her arm. He hugged her hard, burying his head in her shoulder, and she held him as tightly as she could, rocking back and forth and making the sorts of soft noises she'd made to him when he was tiny.
"It'll be all right, baby," she whispered to him. "It will."
She heard him swallow and felt his small, square back move under her hand.
"Yeah?"
His voice quivered a little, and he sniffed hard, then tried again.
"Yeah. But what's going to be all right, ma'am? What's going on?"
He drew away a little then, looking up at her with eyes that held more questions and more knowledge than any 9-year-old should reasonably have.
"Mandy says you put Mr. Cameron in the priest's hall. But he's not there now. I looked."
A cold hand stroked her nape as she remembered the shock of the empty hall.
"No, he's not." "But you didn't let him out, did you?"
"No, I didn't let him out. He..."
"So somebody else did?"
he said positively.
"Who do you think?"
"You have a very logical mind," she said, smiling a little despite herself.
"You get it from your grandad Jamie." "He said I got it from Granny Clare,"
Jem replied, but automatically. He wasn't to be distracted. I thought maybe it was the man who chased me at the dam. But he couldn't have been here letting Mr. Cameron out at the same time he was chasing me. Could he?
A sudden fear showed in his eyes, and she choked back the overwhelming urge to hunt the man down and kill him like a rabid skunk. The man had got away at the dam, running off into the dark when the police showed up. But God help her, she was going to find him one day, and then... But this was not the day. The problem now was to stop him, or Rob Cameron, from getting anywhere near her kids again.
Then she got what Jemmy was saying, and felt the chill she carried in her heart spread like hoarfrost through her body.
"You mean there has to be another man?" she said, surprised at how calm she sounded. "Mr. Cameron, the man at the dam, and whoever let Mr. Cameron out of the priest's hole."
"Could be a lady," Jemmy pointed out. He seemed less scared talking about it. That was a good thing, because her own skin was rippling with fear.
"Do you know what Granny calls goosebumps?" She held out her arm, the fine reddish hairs all standing on end.
"Horripilation."
"Horripilation,"
Jemmy repeated, and gave a small nervous giggle.
"I like that word."
"Me too." She took a deep breath and stood up. "Go pick out a change of clothes and your PJs, would you, sweetheart? I have to make a couple of phone calls. And then, I think, we're going to go visit Auntie Fiona."
Chapter 33. It's best to sleep in a heel skin. Roger woke suddenly, but without shock. No sense of abandoned dreams, no half-heard noise, but his eyes were open and he was fully aware. It was perhaps an hour before sunrise. He'd left the shutters open, the room was cold, and the clouded sky, the colour of a black pearl. He lay motionless, listening to his heartbeat, and realised that for the first time in several days it wasn't pounding. He wasn't afraid. The fear and turmoil of the night, the terror of the last few days had vanished. His body was completely relaxed, so was his mind. There was something floating in his mind. Absurdly, it was a line from Johnny Cope. "It's best to sleep in a heel skin, for 'twill be a bloody morning." Weirder still, he could hear, could almost feel himself singing it, in his old voice, full of power and enthusiasm.
"Not that I'm ungrateful,"
he said to the whitewashed ceiling beams, his morning voice cracked and rough.
"But what the hell?"
He wasn't sure whether he was talking to God or to his own unconscious, but the likelihood of getting a straight answer was probably the same in either case. He heard the soft thud of a closing door somewhere below, and someone outside whistling through his or her teeth. Annie or Senga, maybe, on the way to the morning milking. A knock came on his own door. Jenny Murray, tidy in a white pinny, dark curly hair tied back but not yet capped for the day, with a jug of hot water, a pot of soft soap, and a razor for shaving.
"Da says, can you ride a horse?"
she said without preamble, looking him up and down in an assessing sort of way.
"I can,"
he replied gruffly, taking the towel-wrapped jug from her. He needed badly to clear the phlegm from his throat and spit, but couldn't bring himself to do that in front of her. Consequently, he just nodded and muttered, "Tank," as he took the razor, instead of asking why.
"Breakfast'll be in the kitchen when you are," she said matter-of-factly. "Bring the jug down, eh?"
An hour later, filled to bursting with hot tea, parich, bannocks with honey and black pudding, he found himself on an autumn shaggy horse following Brian Fraser through the rising mist of early morning.
"We'll go round to the Crofts nearby,"
Fraser had told him over breakfast, spooning strawberry preserves onto a bannock.
"Even if no one's seen your lad, and to be honest,"
his wide mouth twisted in apology,
"I think I should have heard already if anyone had seen a stranger in the district. They'll pass on the word." "Aye. Thanks very much,"
he'd said, meaning it. Even in his own time, gossip was the fastest way of spreading news in the Highlands. No matter how fast Rob Cameron might travel, Roger doubted he could outpace the speed of talk, and the thought made him smile. Jenny caught it and smiled back sympathetically, and he thought again what a very pretty lass she was. The sky was still low and threatening, but impending rain had never yet deterred anyone in Scotland from doing anything and wasn't likely to start now. His throat felt much better for the hot tea, and the odd sense of calm with which he'd waked was still with him. Something had changed in the night. Maybe it was sleeping in Lallybroch, among the ghosts of his own future. Perhaps that had settled his mind while he slept. Maybe it was answered prayer and a moment of grace. Maybe it was no more than Samuel Beckett's bloody existential, "I can't go on, I'll go on." If he had a choice, and he did, Beckett be damned, he'd go with grace. Whatever had caused it, he wasn't disoriented any longer, thrown off balance by what he knew about the futures of the people around him. There was still a deep concern about them, and the need to find Jem still filled him. But now it was a quiet, hard thing in his core, a focus, a weapon, something to brace his back against. He straightened his shoulders as he thought this, and at the same time he saw Brian's straight, flat back and the broad, firm shoulders under the dark set of his tartan coat. They were the echo of Jamie's and the promise of Jem's. Life goes on. It was his job above all to rescue Jem, as much for Brian Fraser's sake as for his own. And now he knew what had changed him, and gave thanks to God for what was indeed grace. He'd slept and waked in a whole skin, and however bloody the mornings to come, he had direction now, calmness and hope, because the good man who rode before him was on his side. They visited more than a dozen crofts in the course of the day, and stopped a tinker they met along the way as well. No one had seen a stranger recently, with or without a red-haired lad, but all promised to spread the word, and all without exception offered their prayers for Roger and his quest. They stopped for supper and the night with a family named Murray that had a substantial farmhouse, though nothing to rival Lallybroch. The owner, John Murray, turned out in the course of conversation to be Brian Fraser's factor, the overseer of much of the physical business of Lallybroch's estate, and he lent his grave attention to Roger's story. An elderly, long-faced man with raw-boned, muscular arms, he sucked his teeth consideringly, nodding his head.
I'll send one of my lads doon in the morn, he said. But if you've found nae trace of this fellow up along the Hieland passes, might be as you should go down to the garrison and tell your tale, Mr. Mackenzie.
Brian Fraser cocked a dark brow, half frowning at this, but then nodded.
Aye, that's no a bad thought, John.
He turned to Roger.
It's some distance, Ken, the garrison's in Fort William, down by Duncansborough, but we could ask along our way, and the soldiers send messengers regularly betwixt the garrison, Inverness and Edinburgh. Should they hear a thing about your man, they could get word to us swiftly.
And they could maybe arrest the fellow on the spot,
Murray added, his rather melancholy countenance brightening a bit at the idea.
Morantine,
Roger said, bowing a little to them both in acknowledgement. Then, turning to Fraser,
I'll do that, and thanks. But, sir, you needn't go with me. You've business of your own to tend to, and I wouldn't...
I'll come and glad to,
Fraser interrupted him firmly.
The hay's long since in, and naught to do that John canna take care of for me.
He smiled at Murray, who made a small noise, halfway between a sigh and a cough, but nodded.
Fort William's in the midst of the Camerons' land forby,
Murray observed absently, gazing off towards the dark fields. They had dined with his family, but then come out to the dooryard, ostensibly to share a pipe. It smouldered in Murray's hand, disregarded for the moment. Brian made a non-committal sound in his throat, and Roger wondered just what Murray meant. Was it a warning that Rob Cameron might have relatives or allies to whom he was heading? Or was there some tension or difficulty between some of the Camerons and the Frasers of Lovett? Or between the Camerons and the Mackenzies? That presented some difficulty. If there was a feud of any importance going on, Roger ought already to know about it. He gave a small, grave, himself, and resolved to approach any Camerons with caution. At the same time, was Rob Cameron intending to seek refuge or help with the Camerons of this time? Had he maybe come to the past before, and had a hiding place prepared among his own clan? That was an evil thought, and Roger felt his stomach tighten as though to resist a punch. But no, there hadn't been time. If Cameron had only learned about time travel from the guide Roger had written for his children's eventual use, he wouldn't have had time to go to the past, find ancient Camerons, and... No, ridiculous. Roger shook off the tangle of half-formed thoughts as though they were a fishing net thrown over his head. There was nothing more to be done until they reached the garrison tomorrow. Murray and Fraser were leaning on the fence now, sharing the pipe, and chatting casually in Gaelic.
"My daughter bids me ask after your son," Brian Fraser said with an air of casualness. "Any word?"
Murray snorted, smoke purling from his mouth, and said something very idiomatic about his son. Fraser grinned in sympathy and shook his head.
"At least she can he's alive," he said, dropping back into English.
"Like enough he'll come home when he's had his fill of fighting. We did, aye?"
He nudged Murray gently in the ribs, and the taller man snorted again, but with less ferocity.
"It was no boredom that led us here, Achinyahu. Not you, anyway."
He raised one shaggy, greying brow, and Fraser laughed, though Roger thought there was a regretful edge in it. He remembered the story very well. Brian Fraser, a bastard of old Lord Lovett's, had stolen Ellen Mackenzie from her brothers, Colum and Dougal, the Mackenzies of Castle Leoch, and had ended up at last with her at Lallybroch, the pair of them more or less disowned by both clans, but at least left alone by them. He'd seen the portrait of Ellen, too, tall, red-haired, and undeniably a woman worth the effort. She'd looked very much like her granddaughter, Brianna. By reflex, he closed his eyes, breathed deep of the cold highland evening, and thought he felt her there at his side. If he opened them again, might he see her standing in the smoke? "I'll come back," he thought to her. "No matter what, Anian Ruai, I'm coming back. With Jem."
Chapter 34. Sanctuary. It was nearly an hour's drive over the narrow, twisting highland roads from Lallybroch to Fiona Buchan's new house in Inverness. Plenty of time for Brianna to wonder if she was doing the right thing, if she had any right to involve Fiona and her family in a matter that looked more dangerous by the moment. Plenty of time to get a stiff neck from looking over her shoulder, though if she was being followed, how would she know? She'd had to tell the kids where Roger was, as gently and briefly as possible. Mandy had put a thumb in her mouth and stared gravely at her, round-eyed. Jem. Jem hadn't said anything, but had gone white under his freckles and looked as though he was about to throw up. She glanced in the rear-view mirror. He was hunched in a corner of the back seat now, face turned to the window. "You'll come back, honey," she'd said, trying to hug him in reassurance. He'd let her, but stood stiff in her arms, stricken.
"It's my fault," he'd said, his voice small and wooden as a puppet's. "I should have got away sooner, and Dad wouldn't."
"It's not your fault," she'd said firmly. "It's Mr. Cameron's fault, and no one else's. You were very brave, and Daddy will come back really soon."
Jem had swallowed hard, but said nothing in reply. When she'd let him go, he'd swayed for a moment, and Mandy had come up and hugged his legs.
"Daddy'll come back," she said encouragingly, "for supper."
"It might take a little bit longer than that," Bree said,
smiling in spite of the panic packed like a snowball under her ribs. She drew a deep breath of relief as the highway opened out near the airport, and she could go faster than 30 miles an hour. Another wary glance in the mirror, but the road was empty behind her. She stepped on the gas. Fiona was one of the only two people who knew. The other was in Boston, her mother's oldest friend, Joe Abernathy. But she needed sanctuary for Jem and Mandy right now. She couldn't stay with them at Lallybroch. The walls were 2 feet thick in places, yes, but it was a farm manor, not a fortified tower house, and hadn't been built with any notion that the inhabitants might need to repel invaders or stand off a siege. Being in the city gave her a sense of relief. Having people around, witnesses, camouflage, help. She pulled up in the street outside the Craig Nadun Bed and Breakfast, 3 AA stars, with the sense of an exhausted swimmer crawling up onto shore. The timing was good. It was early afternoon. Fiona would have finished the cleaning, and it wouldn't yet be time to check in new guests or start the supper. A little painted bell in the shape of a bluebell tinkled when they opened the door, and one of Fiona's daughters instantly popped an inquiring head out of the lounge. "Auntie Bree!" she shouted, and at once the lobby was filled with children as Fiona's three girls pushed one another out of the way to hug Bree, pick up Mandy, and tickle Jem, who promptly dropped to all fours and crawled under the bench where folk left their wraps. "What? Oh, it's you, Hen!" Fiona, coming out of the kitchen in a workmanlike canvas apron that said Pie Queen on the front, smiled with delight at sight of Bree and enveloped her in a flowery hug. "What's wrong?" Fiona murmured in her ear under cover of the embrace. She drew back a bit, still holding Bree, and looked up at her, squinting in half-playful worry. "Rog playing away from home, is he?"
"You could say that," Bree managed with a smile,
but evidently not a very good one, because Fiona at once clapped her hands, bringing order out of the chaos in the lobby, and dispatched all the children to the upstairs lounge to watch telly. Jem, looking hunted, was coaxed out from under the bench and reluctantly followed the girls, looking back over his shoulder at his mother. She smiled and made shooing motions at him, then followed Fiona into the kitchen, glancing by reflex over her own shoulder. The tea kettle screamed, interrupting Brianna, but not before she'd got to the most salient point of her story. Fiona warmed and filled the pot, purse-lipped with concentration.
"You say he took the rifle. You still got your shotgun?"
"Yes. It's under the front seat of my car at the moment." Fiona nearly dropped the pot. Brianna shot out an arm and grabbed the handle, steadying it. Her hands were freezing, and the warm china felt wonderful.
"Well, I wasn't going to leave it in a house the bastards have a key to now, was I?"
Fiona set down the pot and crossed herself.
"God between us and evil."
She sat, giving Brianna a sharp look.
"And you're quite sure it's bastards, plural?"
"Yes, I bloody am," Bree said tersely.
"Even if Rob Cameron managed to grow wings and fly out of my priest's hole. Let me tell you what happened to Jem at the dam."
She did, in a few brief sentences, by the end of which Fiona was glancing over her own shoulder at the closed kitchen door. She looked back at Bree, settling herself. In her early 30s, she was a pleasantly rounded young woman with a lovely face, and the calm expression of a mother who normally has the Indian sign on her offspring. But at the moment she had a look that Brianna's own mother would have described as blood in her eye. She said something very bad in English regarding the man who chased Jem.
"So then," she said, picking up a paring knife from the nearby drain board and examining the edge critically, "what shall we do?"
Bree drew a breath and sipped cautiously at the hot, milky tea. It was sweet, silky, and very comforting. But not nearly as comforting as that we. Well, first, would you let Jem and Mandy stay here while I go do a few things? It might be overnight. I brought their pajamas just in case. She nodded at the paper sack that she'd set down on one of the chairs.
Aye, of course.
A small frown formed between Fiona's dark brows.
What sorts of things?
It's... Brianna began, intending to say, better if you don't know. But in fact, someone had better know where she was going and what she was doing. Just in case she didn't come back. A little bubble of what might be either fear or anger rose up through the sense of warmth in her middle. I'm going to visit Jock McLeod in hospital. He's the night watchman who found Jem at the dam. He might know the man who hit him and tried to take Jem. And he does know Rob Cameron. He could maybe tell me who Cameron's mates are outside of work or in lodge. She rubbed a hand down over her face, thinking, after that, I'll talk to Rob's sister and his nephew. If she's not involved in whatever he's up to, she'll be worried. And if she is involved, then I need to know that. Do you think you'll be able to tell? Fiona's frown had eased a bit, but she still looked worried. Oh, yes, Brianna said with grim determination. I'll be able to tell. For one thing, if someone I talk to is involved, they're probably likely to try to stop me asking questions. Fiona made a small noise that could best be spelled as "ee," indicating deep concern. Brianna drank the last of her tea and set down the cup with an explosive sigh. And then, she said, I'm going back to Lallybroch to meet a locksmith and have him change all the locks and install burglar alarms on the lower windows. She looked questioningly at Fiona. I don't know how long it might take.
Aye, and that's why you've brought the kids' nighties. Nae problem, hen.
She chewed her lower lip, eyeing Brianna. Bree knew what she was thinking, debating whether to ask or not, and saved her the trouble.
I don't know what I'm going to do about Roger, she said steadily.
He'll come back, surely, Fiona began. But Bree shook her head. Horrifying realization number 3 couldn't be denied any longer.
I don't think so, she said, although she bit her lip as if to keep the words from escaping.
He can't know that Jem isn't there, and he'd never abandon him. Fiona was clasping Brianna's hand in both of her own.
No, of course he wouldn't do that. But if he and the other fellow go on searching and find no trace, eventually, surely he'd think...
Her voice died away. She tried to imagine what Roger might think under those circumstances.
Oh, he'll be thinking all right, Bree said,
and managed a small, shaky laugh.
The thought of Roger's determination, the growing sense of fear and desperation that must inevitably eat away at it, his fight to keep going because he would. He'd never give up and come back to tell her Jem was lost for good. If he didn't find any trace of Jem, what could he think? That Cameron had maybe killed Jem, hidden his body, and gone to America in search of the gold?
Or that they had both been lost in that horrifying space between one time and another, never to be found?
Well, and he'll be playing too, Fiona said with a brisk squeeze of Bree's hand. I can help with that.
That made tears well. And she blinked hard, scrumming at her eyes with a paper napkin.
I can't cry now, she said in a choked voice. I can't. I haven't got time.
She stood up suddenly, pulling her hand free. She sniffed, blew her nose hard on the napkin, and sniffed again.
Fiona, I know you haven't told anybody about us, she began.
And even she could hear the doubt in her own voice. Fiona snorted.
I have not, she said,
I'd be taken off to the booby hatch, and what would Ernie do with the girls and all?
Why, she added, giving Brianna a hard look, what are you thinking?
Well, the women who dance at Craig na Doon, do you think any of them know what it is?
Fiona sucked in one cheek, thinking.
One or two of the older ones might have an idea, she said slowly. We've been calling down the sun on Beltane there for as far back as anyone knows. And some things do get passed down, Ken. Be strange if nobody ever wondered. But even if someone can for sure what happens there, they'd not speak. No more than I would.
Right. I just wondered. Could you maybe find out quietly if any of the women have ties to Rob Cameron, or maybe to the Orkneys?
To what?
Fiona's eyes went round.
Why the Orkneys?
Because Rob Cameron went on archaeological digs there. And I think that's what made him interested in stone circles to start with. I know one man named Callahan, a friend of Roger's, who worked up there with him. And I'll talk to him, too. Maybe tomorrow. I don't think I'll have time today. But if there's anyone else who might be connected with things like that...
It was more than a long shot, but at the moment she was inclined to look under any stone she could lift.
I'll call round, Fiona said thoughtfully. And speak of calling. Telephone me if you're not coming back tonight, aye?
Just so as I know you're safe.
Bree nodded, her throat tight, and hugged Fiona, taking one more moment's strength from her friend. Fiona saw her down the hall to the front door, pausing at the foot of the stair, and glanced toward the chatter coming from above.
Did Bree want to say goodbye to Jem and Mandy?
Wordless, Brianna shook her head.
Her feelings were too raw. She couldn't hide them sufficiently and didn't want to scare the kids.
Instead, she pressed her fingers to her lips and blew a kiss up the stairs, then turned to the door.
That shotgun, Fiona began behind her and stopped.
Brianna turned and raised an eyebrow.
They kinda get ballistics off buckshot, can they?
Chapter 35.
A Kersden.
They reached Fort William in early afternoon of the second day's travel.
How large is the garrison?
Roger asked, eyeing the stone walls of the fort. It was modest as forts went, with only a few buildings and a drill yard within the surrounding walls.
Maybe 40 men, I'd say,
Brian replied, turning sideways to allow a pair of red-coated guards carrying muskets to pass him in the narrow entry passage.
Fort Augustus is the only garrison north of it, and that's got maybe 100.
That was surprising, or maybe not.
If Roger was right about the date, it would be another 3 years before there was much talk of Jacobites in the Highlands, let alone enough of it to alarm the English crown into sending troops en masse to keep a lid on the situation.
The fort was open, and any number of civilians appeared to have business with the army, judging from the small crowd near one building. Fraser steered him toward another, smaller one, with a tilt of his head, though.
We'll see the commander, I think.
You know him?
A worm of curiosity tickled his spine.
Surely it was too early for... I've met him the once. Buncombe, he's called. Seems a decent fellow for a Sassenach.
Fraser gave his name to a clerk in the outer room, and within a moment they were ushered into the commander's office.
Oh.
A small middle-aged man in uniform with tired eyes behind a pair of half-spectacles, half-rose, half-bowed, and dropped back into his seat as though the effort of recognition had exhausted him.
Broch Turoch. Your servant, sir.
Perhaps it had, Roger thought. The man's face was gaunt and lined, and his breath whistled audibly in his lungs. Claire might have known specifically what was up with Captain Buncombe, but it didn't take a doctor to know that something was physically amiss. Still, Buncombe listened civilly to his story, called in the clerk to make a careful note of Cameron's description and Jem's, and promised that these would be circulated to the garrison, and that any patrols or messengers would be advised to ask after the fugitives. Brian had thoughtfully brought along a couple of bottles in his saddlebags, and now produced one, which he set on the desk with a gurgling thump of enticement.
"We thank you, sir, for your help, if you'd allow us to present a small token of appreciation for your kindness."
A small but genuine smile appeared on Captain Buncombe's worn face.
"I would, sir, but only if you gentlemen will join me." "Ah, yes."
Two worn pewter cups, and after a brief search, a crystal goblet with a chip out of the rim were produced, and the blessed silence of the dram fell upon the tiny office. After a few moments' reverence, Buncombe opened his eyes and sighed.
"Amazing, sir. Your own manufacture, is it?"
Brian inclined his head with a modest shake.
"Nay, but a few bottles at Hogmanay, just for the family."
Roger had himself seen the root cellar from which Brian had chosen the bottle, lined from floor to ceiling with small casks, and with an atmosphere to it that would have knocked a moose flat had he stayed to breathe it long. But an instant's thought told him that it was probably wiser not to let a garrison full of soldiers know that you kept any sort of liquor in large quantities on your premises, no matter what terms you were on with their commander. He caught Brian's eye, and Fraser looked aside with a small "mm-hmm," and a tranquil smile.
"Amazing,"
Buncombe repeated, and tipped another inch into his glass, offering the bottle round. Roger followed Brian's lead, and refused, nursing his own drink, while the other two men fell into a sort of conversation he recognised very well. Not friendly, but courteous. A trade of information that might be of advantage to one or both, and a careful avoidance of anything that might give the other too much advantage. He'd seen Jamie do it any number of times in America. It was headman's talk, and there were rules to it. Of course, Jamie must have seen his da do it any number of times himself. It was bred in his bones. He thought Jem maybe had it. He had something that made people look at him twice. Something beyond the hair, he amended, and smiled to himself. While Buncombe occasionally directed a question to him, Roger was for the most part able to leave them to it, and he gradually relaxed. The rain had passed, and a beam of sun from the window rested on his shoulders, warming him from without as the whisky warmed him within. He felt for the first time that he might be accomplishing something in his search, rather than merely flailing desperately round the Highlands.
"And they could maybe arrest the fellow,"
John Murray had remarked, anent the soldiers and Rob Cameron.
A comforting thought, that.
A clan angle, though. He didn't think Cameron could have accomplices here. But, he straightened in his chair, he had an accomplice from this time, didn't he? Buck had the gene. And while it was clearly less frequent to travel forward from one's original lifeline... Well, Roger thought it was less frequent. His own lack of knowledge was an unnerving realization in itself. Buck had done it. If Cameron was a traveller, he'd got the gene from an ancestor who could also have done it. Chill was running through his veins like iced wine, killing the whiskey's warmth, and a sinister tangle of cold worms came writhing into his mind. Could it be a conspiracy, maybe? Between Buck and Rob Cameron, or Buck and some ancient Cameron from his own time. He'd never thought Buck was telling the whole truth about himself, or his own journey through the stones. Could all this have been a plot to lure Roger away from Lallybroch? Away from Bree? Now the worms were bloody eating his brain. He picked up his cup and threw back the rest of the whiskey at a gulp to kill them. Buncombe and Fraser both glanced at him in surprise, but then courteously resumed their conversation.
In the cold light of his present state of mind, something else now cast new shadows. Brian Fraser. While Roger had taken Fraser's bringing him to the garrison as purely a helpful gesture toward finding Jem, it had another function, didn't it? It displayed Roger to Captain Buncombe in a context that made it clear that he had no claim of clan obligation or personal friendship on Fraser, just in case Roger turned out not to be what he said he was. And it allowed Fraser to see whether Buncombe recognized Roger or not, just in case he wasn't what he said he was. He took a deep breath and pressed his hands on the desktop, concentrating on the feel of the wood grain under his fingers. All right. Perfectly reasonable. How many times had he seen Jamie do the same sort of thing? For these men, the welfare of their own people always came first. They'd protect Lallybroch or Fraser's Ridge above all. But that didn't mean they were unwilling to help when help was in their power to give. And he did believe that Fraser meant to help him. He clung to the thought and found that it floated. Fraser glanced at him again, and something in the man's face eased at whatever it saw in his own. Brian picked up the bottle and poured another inch into Roger's glass. "We'll find him, man," he said softly in Gaelic, before turning to serve Captain Buncombe in turn. He drank and put everything out of his mind, concentrating on the trivia of the conversation. It was all right. Everything was going to be all right. He was still repeating this mantra to himself when he heard shouts and whistles from outside. He glanced toward the window, but it showed nothing save a view of the fort's wall. Captain Buncombe looked startled, but Brian Fraser was on his feet and moving fast. Roger followed, emerging into the fort's drill yard to see a fine-looking young woman mounted on a large, fine-looking horse and glaring down at a small cluster of soldiers who had gathered round her stirrup, pushing one another, snatching at the reins, and shouting remarks up at her. The horse plainly didn't like it, but she was managing to keep it under control. She was also holding a switch in one hand, and, from the look on her face, was plainly choosing a target amongst those presenting themselves.
"Jenny!"
Brian roared, and she looked up, startled.
The soldiers were startled, too. They turned, and seeing Captain Buncombe come out behind the Scot, instantly melted away, heads down as they hurried off about their business.
Roger was at Brian's shoulder when he grabbed the horse's bridle.
"What in the name of the Blessed Mother are you?"
Brian began, furious. But she interrupted him, looking straight at Roger. "Your kinsman," she said. "William Buckley. He sent word to Lallybroch that he's taken bad, and will you come at once? They say he may not live." It took a good day and a half to make the journey, even in good weather. Given that it was raining, that the journey back was uphill, and that the latter portion of it involved stumbling around in the dark, hunting for a nearly invisible trail, they covered the distance in a surprisingly short time.
"I'll come in with you," Brian had said, swinging off his horse in the dooryard. "They're no my tenants, but they know me."
The household... It was a modest crofter's cottage, dull white as a pebble in the light of a gibbous moon, was shut up tight for the night, shutters drawn, and the door bolted. Fraser thumped on the door and shouted in Gaelic, though, identifying himself and saying that he'd brought the sick man's kinsman to him. And presently the door swung open, framing a squat bearded gentleman in shirt and nightcap, who peered at them for a long moment before stepping back with a gruff,
"Come, Ben."
Roger's first impression was that the house was cracked.